Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm dandy.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up, in controversies and non-controversies, no real controversies or non-controversies this week. It's a relatively light week news-wise, so we figured we'd do our yearly top five, or at least the top five that we could get to, given that, you know, studios release every single movie for adults over an 8 or 9 week stretch that ends today, tomorrow maybe, I don't know. I still haven't seen Licorice Pizza, for instance, the new Paul Thomas Anderson film, because it did not open until like 3 days ago here in Dallas, so I'll be seeing that at some point here soon. Maybe it will make some sort of revised top five or top 10 in the future, but not for now. So consider it a top five that we have seen. That's, you know, an important proviso. I've actually already published my top 10, so faithful Sunny Bunch readers won't find a ton of surprises from me on my list, but I'm sure Alyssa and Peter will have lots of good stuff, and we'll probably, I bet we'll have a little bit of overlap here, but we'll see. I don't know. Alyssa, we're going to start with you. What is your number five pick?
I'm actually totally going to cheat. I have like a top seven and refuse to separate them. But are we going, we're counting down from
five? Yeah, I mean, I was planning on going, you know, one, each of us would do one and then, you know, we would
do all the ones that are tied for number five.
We would get to the number one at the same time. But if you want to do your bottom three.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
That's fine.
So my number five is West Side Story, which I thought was gorgeous and overwhelming. But the more I sit with it, the more I think that Ansel Elgort is just not that good as Tony. And that role is tricky in any case because he and Maria are both such dunderheads. But I think Elgort was really the weak link in the film. And that's hard when it's one of your leads.
Yeah, that's fair. I think he is. He did nothing for me in the moment. And I haven't really thought about him much since.
Yeah, I think Face is just so much better than he is as Riff that it's kind of not a fair contest.
I mean, Riff is also just a more interesting character, too, because he's the pot stirrer.
Absolutely. And, you know, represents this sort of, he is damned and knows he's damned and is struggling against it. And knowing that he, you know, sort of knowing that he's going to fail on some level, and also just brings the sort of almost romantic tension to his relationship with Tony in a way that I think is interesting without being overdone.
Peter, what is your fifth pick?
I also had West Side Story in my number five slot. It's a movie I really liked. I have not been as bothered in retrospect by Ansel Elgort's performance, but I have to say, as I've contemplated going back to this movie, it's one I want to see again, and I certainly will see again, probably even in the theaters, once a few things in life clear up to make time for it. But it's one that I've been a little bit hesitant to go back to, like rush back to see, just because of the length. And maybe that's partly because I've seen a lot of 2.5 hour movies over the past month, and all of them have felt at least 10 minutes too long, if not 25, or in the case of House of Gucci, you know, about 50 minutes too long. But this one just sort of feels like, I get why it is as long as it is, but it feels like it overstays its welcome by a little bit. And I'm not quite sure I'm ready to put my butt in the seat for quite that long. If it was a 2-hour and 9-minute movie, I think it would be a little higher on my list and I'd be rushing back to see it.
My number five pick, the fifth best movie I saw this year, is The Last Duel, which I continue to love and be flummoxed by some of the responses to it on Twitter and elsewhere. You know, if you can't handle an adult, you know, discussion about sex and violence and all that stuff, you know, maybe movies just aren't for you. I don't know.
Wait. Movies are for you because Marvel movies don't have any of that stuff. And that's the only thing that matters anymore.
It's true. Alyssa, what is your number four pick? What's your fourth best film?
As sort of companions to each other, I really loved The Card Counter and Dune, which have both really stayed with me as sort of austere movies about moving forward through the world, even though you are damned. Also, they both star Oscar Isaac, and anything with Oscar Isaac is almost certain to crack my top five, sort of no matter what it is. But, you know, I went into The Card Counter, you know, not as a Paul Schrader person, went into Dune, not particularly as a Frank Herbert person, although I've read the books. And the sort of era of inevitability hanging over both of them, I think is just really tremendous. The Card Counter in particular has really stuck with me. The sort of juxtaposition between the kind of eerie, almost narcotized calm with which Schrader shoots the casinos where his main character spends most of his days. And then just the really, you know, the sort of fish-eyed horror of the depictions of Americans torturing Iraqis has really, really stayed with me. No one saw that movie. No one talked about it. But God, is it powerful. And I think, you know, I hope people discover it over time because I thought it was really tremendous.
Peter, what is your fourth best?
I swear to God, Alyssa and I did not talk about this or coordinate it at all, but it is also The Card Counter. And for many of the same reasons. Look, it's yet another Paul Schrader movie about sin and obsession and damaged male psyches. I mean, Taxi Driver is one of my four or five favorite films of all time, a movie I've watched over and over again. I don't think The Card Counter is quite that good, but it is a damn good movie, probably Schrader's best in a decade or more. And it's, you know, part of it is the Oscar Isaac performance at the center of it, which is the best performance I've seen this year, male or female, lead or not, I think of, period. I just think it's the best performance I've seen this year. But part of it is that Schrader is able to do some really tricky work that very few other modern writers or directors are able to pull off in terms of making a movie very specifically about an individual that is also very clearly making a distinct commentary on American culture without making the movie in any way feel didactically political or like he's coming on to, like he's just there to sort of sell you on a message or, you know, or a program. At all.
It's the anti Don't Look Up is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, so I haven't seen Don't Look Up because, you know, end of year issues. But yes, that is my assumption. And I just, like, I mean, I think there is a message. This is a political film. Like, there's no avoiding that. And there is a political message in this movie, which was released on the 20th anniversary weekend of 9/11. And that was not a coincidence. And I think a lot of people, even people who liked the movie, overlooked that a little bit. But doesn't feel like a movie that's hitting you over the head with anything. It feels like a movie that is just asking you to sympathize with a really damaged person who has been through a lot, who is somebody who is hard to love, but needs love.
The Peter Sudermann story. All right, number four was Red Rocket, which I don't know if you guys have seen, but it's Sean Baker's latest. He's the guy who made The Florida Project and Tangerine. I really, really love The Florida Project, and I wasn't really expecting much going into this. I hadn't read a ton about it before seeing it, and it is, in, I think, a very real way, the defining film of the kind of Trump era of American politics. I mean, it's set in 2016 when the conventions are going on, so that's kind of like background noise. And there are like, you know, Trump, Make America Great Again flags in the background, whatever. But it's not about Trump. He's not a character. He's not really mentioned or talked about or discussed, really. But it is about a very Trump-like figure. The main character, who's played by Simon Rex, is a hustler. He's a con man. He's always talking about, you know, all these great things that he's done. And as the film unspools, we realize that he has been kind of inflating all of that. And yet he is very charismatic. He's able to pull people in and get them to do things they would otherwise not do, debase themselves in certain ways, which again feels very familiar to some of us. But Red Rocket, number four, good movie. Check it out. It's in theaters now.
I got to say, I'm jealous that you've been able to see that. I'm not sure how I would have seen that up until now, not being a member of the Washington Area Film Critics Association and just having to see movies at screenings and at...
Yeah, I mean, this is one of these classic, came out in New York and L.A.
I don't think it's available in D.C., which is not a tiny market.
It should be out in D.C. now. It should be in at least one or two theaters.
Unless it came out in the last week.
Yeah, I think it came out this weekend. I think it came out... Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's around. People check it out or catch it on VOD when it hits VOD and... 3 months or 6 weeks or whenever. But it's a good movie. Check it out. Number three, Alyssa.
I'm going to be a pain again and say for me it's Zola and The Last Duel, which are two movies, both true stories, that in each in their own way and separated by centuries are about women attempting to sort of reassert the rules that they thought existed about sex and violence. And I, you know, I was not someone who followed the original like Zola Twitter thread about a stripper's like trip to work trip to Florida gone badly wrong. But Jessica Bravo did a really fascinating job of both sort of preserving the internet-y voice of the original thread. The only other work that I think remotely did as well as that this year was Patricia Lockwood's No One Is Talking About This, which is probably the best novel I read all year. But also at just getting at the sort of menace and terror of being in a situation that is not what you thought it was. And that's helped a lot by Coleman Domingo's really great, unnerving performance as a pimp. But it's just, it's a movie about a woman trying to sort of wrest control back of a situation that's gone completely off the rails. And The Last Duel is, you know, again, a true story, very much about the same thing. And Ridley Scott, I think, does something really impressive in the way that he depicts a rape from multiple perspectives and gets at the unsteadiness of, you know, the narrator's experiences of similar events. I think they're really outstanding companion pieces. They're both great.
Peter.
So for my number three, I have The French Dispatch, which is a great comic morality play. It's a great movie about magazines and about writers and editors and the beautiful weirdness of the writer-editor relationship, of every individual writer-editor relationship. It's a great movie about the power of personal and idiosyncratic art to give life meaning and joy, but even to save. And it's just it's a wonderful expression of everything that Wes Anderson has come to stand for it and care about over, you know, 25 years or so now. And I think one of his better movies overall.
Number three for me is The Card Counter, which you guys have already talked about a bit. One thing I just want to highlight that you guys didn't really talk about is that Paul Schrader is a poker player, and he kind of understands the kind of dingier aspects of poker playing, in the sense that, like, when you go and play cards for 6 hours in a casino, it's not like a dungeon like in Rounders, right? And it's not like high class and glitzy like some of the poker movies you see. It's basically you're sitting at a kind of a crappy table with a bunch of people not doing anything for long stretches of time, with fluorescent lights overhead and stale cigarette smoke hanging in the background and like cold coffee in front of you. That's the life of a poker player, and it very effectively kind of translates that on screen. It is.
I mean, especially given his choice of locations, right? He didn't bring us to Las Vegas. He didn't bring us anywhere classy. It's Atlantic City and Louisiana, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. And like the, you know, and like reservation casinos. Yeah. I mean, he's hitting the lowlights of the poker tour.
Deliberately playing for sort of smaller stakes, et cetera.
So good movie. Check it out. Good movie about poker, in addition to, you know, sin and the soul of America and all that stuff, but specifically cards. All right. Second best movie, Alyssa.
The French Dispatch and The Green Knight, which are both effectively short story collections that are designed to immerse you in an entirely different milieu than the one you occupy. One of them, that portrayed in The Green Knight, is much stranger than the other, The French Dispatch. But both of them are just really sort of transporting anecdotal movies that look sensational. You know, The French Dispatch looks great in all of the Wes Anderson-y ways, but The Green Knight is just unbelievably gorgeous. And it was one of the movies that made me feel really, really good about being back in a theater.
Peter.
My second favorite movie of the year is Dune, Denis Villeneuve's adaptation of the first half of Frank Herbert's novel. It's the only new movie this year that I have seen three times already. And man, I'm looking forward to seeing it many, many more. I've already ordered the 4K disc, and I'm so excited to have it in a couple of weeks here.
Peter, they're going to put out a set that has both of them. It's going to have part one and part two
and
together. You just have to be patient.
I'll buy that with like a little plaster casted worm that comes with it or whatever, and like display it on my shelf. And I'll be so proud of myself for having that thing sitting there on my shelf, even if I never even open it.
I insist that you come to the podcast in a full God Emperor of Dune sandworm costume.
It's just a total sensory experience, and it's so overwhelming. And it is, I think, the only movie ever to truly capture the sensation of reading classic science fiction. Now, obviously, it's adapting a sort of post-Golden Age, post-Silver Age, you know, work. But Frank Herbert was obviously informed by all of the Asimov, Heinlein, Arthur C. Clarke stuff that I grew up reading. And a lot of that sort of filters both through Frank Herbert and then through this movie. And it just sort of gets big, epic, at-scale science fiction, the sensibility of those works in a way that I have never, ever seen on screen before. I'm super excited to hear that after Denis Villeneuve does part two, he's looking at adapting Rendezvous with Rama, another movie about enormity and about living in a universe that is so big that you can barely comprehend it. And I like that that's his take on the rest of, on like life outside of planet Earth, is that like, oh my gosh, folks, it's so big. There's so much of it. Our tiny little puny human brains will never fully grasp it. But I'm going to try and put it on screen.
Dune didn't make my top five, but it did make my top 10 because it is simply the best theatrical experience that I've had all year. Like you cannot understand what this movie is and what it is doing without seeing it in a theater. So you should have gone to see it in a theater when you had the chance.
If you spent a little bit of scratch on a home theater, it's a great,
it's not even close.
It's not even close.
It's not even
how
close
good
to
your
the
home
same
theater
thing.
Is.
So, sorry.
I mean, you get to find out how you, part of it is you get to find out the gap between your home theater and an Atmos, you know, a Dolby Atmos room.
Which is the same, which is going to be huge because it's just not as good. All right. Second best movie I saw this year is The French Dispatch for all of the reasons that Alyssa mentioned, but also because it has the best portrayal of an editor I think I've ever seen. Bill Murray doing his thing where he's very, very he has this whole complex system of payment in his head that he explains to people and also is constantly complaining about expenses while also paying them. A very important part of any editor's job. Understands that when a writer takes out something important, he needs to put it back in. He captures all of the things that an editor does very well. And he has a sort of world-weary annoyance about him. Again, not saying all editors are like that, but, you know, one or two of them. All right. Best movie of the year, Alyssa.
Pig, which is the movie that surprised the hell out of me most this year.
Are all three of us going to pick Pig?
Yep.
Is that what's happening here?
I think
here?
That's
okay.
Likely.
Well, right. It's like Pig plus.
Okay.
So an Alyssa style cheating at the top five. Yeah. I mean, Pig was, I think all of us went into it sort of expecting it to be like Fight Club with a truffle pig or, you know, John Wick with a truffle pig. And instead, it is something so much stranger and more beautiful and empathetic. It's got Fight Club. It's got, you know, a man desperately in search of his animal companion. But it also has sort of Beasts of the Southern Wild style, strange meditations on the inevitability of climate catastrophe and, you know, profound acts of empathy enacted through cooking. And I think the conversation with the chef at the high-end restaurant is maybe just my pick for the best scene of the year, not because it is, you know, particularly flashy, but because of the way it is written and acted as a total dissection of a man's soul in about 5 minutes, done not out of cruelty, but out of sort of deep compassion and understanding that you don't necessarily expect. I just think it's spectacular and surprising. And you know what? The movie should be surprising. I recognize that I am the Marvel scold on this podcast. I am the person who sort of burned out on people getting exactly what they want at the theater. But Pig is a great illustration of why you should go into stuff that you're not sure what it's going to be. You're not sure you're going to like it. You're not even sure what the damn thing is, because sometimes what it is just transcendent.
Peter.
So my alternative pick is Hawkeye, the limited series on Disney Plus, just because I've been feeling not very good and I've been watching it and it's so comforting. It's just sort of pleasant. But no, Pig is the best movie of the year by far. Like with that, it's just, that's why I go see the movies, is to see Nicolas Cage make chicken in Pig and like to be sad and weird and understated. And it's such a great movie about human connection, but also about the finiteness of life, right? And so much of this movie is about the fact that life ends for each individual person, but also for like all of human civilization, right? At some point, Portland's going to be underwater and none of this will matter.
But in the meantime, eat a salted baguette.
Right. In the meantime, eat something wonderful and enjoy that it was made with care. And make something with care yourself for other people, because that's what we can do, and that's the kindness we can show to them. It's a great movie. I loved it. I haven't actually gone back to watch it again, just because I've had so many other things to watch, but I'm it's one that I really want to see again.
It's on Hulu.
It's also
it's on Hulu. I watched it.
It's recently. The perfect length, right? It's like, is it 91 minutes or 89 minutes or something? I mean, it's...
I think it's just under 100
it
minutes.
It might be 98 minutes, right? It's so perfectly... And it doesn't feel like it's chopped short at all. It feels like it's just exactly the perfect length, a complete story, a complete portrayal of a world and a set of characters. And it doesn't have to belabor the point, and it doesn't have to be an epic. It just has to locate you there and pick exactly the right details.
Yeah. I also picked Pig. Nobody has really talked about Alex Wolff, who is the junior food procurer who is you know, working with Nicolas Cage's character to get truffles into the city. And he is just wonderful in this. Like, there are just so many nice little character touches. Like, he listens to classical music, but not really classical music. He listens to, like, classical music explainers, and can't quite understand why that's an issue. His relationship with his dad and with his mom, like, there's this just wonderful little moment in a hospital where he is lamenting the fact that she is hanging on, without life, so to speak. So good movie, great performances. Everybody loved Pig. It's like I said, it's on Hulu now. It's on Hulu. You can go stream it if you got Hulu. Good movie. Check it out.
It's also worth noting that this is director Michael Sarnowski's first feature. Which
yeah,
feels
I didn't even
insane.
Realize that. I didn't realize that until I was putting together the critics picks list for IndieWire. They were in one of the categories is first feature, and I was like, oh, I had no idea that this was his first movie.
It's
made for Neon, or it was acquired by Neon. I don't know if Neon actually made it, but it is the sort of movie that, like, if you watch a lot of Nick Cage movies that he has made recently, they all look cheap and kind of terrible, and they're all lit like NBC sitcoms. And this is not. This is lit like a real movie, with lots of ambient light, and just, it's great. Great movie. Okay, if you enjoy the show, and who doesn't, it's great, please head over to atma.thebulwark.com, where we're going to have a special bonus episode on our favorite non-Matrix Wachowski movie. Speaking of the Wachowskis, or one of them anyway, and please switch this off if you're worried about spoilers. Because I'm going to be talking about the plot in my intro, and there's going to be spoiler talk throughout. So if you're worried about spoilers and you haven't seen the movie, Matrix Resurrections, which is on HBO Max now, it's in theaters. No excuse if you want to watch it before listening to this, go watch it. But we're going to be talking about plot stuff, so spoilers. Anyway, on to the main event. The Matrix Resurrections, a movie that posits the original trilogy as a whole is regarded as an unrivaled masterpiece beloved by all, and that Neo is a real guy, really named Thomas Anderson, who really did all of those things and has been trapped in the Matrix again. And now he's there, and they got to get him out again for some reason. Indeed, most of the first hour or so of this film is kind of a winking, metatextual joke about the absurdity of reboots and remakes and corporatized culture, like, for instance, The Matrix Resurrections, right? And this is my first complaint with the movie. Continually calling attention to the fact that you are an unnecessary corporate cash grab does not lessen the fact that you are making an unnecessary corporate cash grab. Like, you can't just say, like, oh, look at us, we're doing this and it's so bad. But no, that's not how it works. And that would be fine and maybe even kind of clever if the takeaway of this whole section of the film wasn't, and I don't think I'm exaggerating here, wasn't bullet time is stupid, or praising bullet time in excess of everything else is stupid. Because that's my takeaway from the joke that involves a bunch of the corporate programming drones talking about, you know, they're debating, what does the Matrix mean? Is it trans politics, or is it corporate media? Is it blah, 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 red pill, blue pill? You know, what does it mean? Before settling wrongly, I think, in the film and the filmmaker's eyes on bullet time, right? The filmmakers here, director Lana Wachowski, who co-wrote with David Mitchell and Alexander Heman, seem almost vexed that bullet time, rather than, I don't know, Baudelaire or whatever became shorthand Baudrillard, for the franchise.
Not Baudelaire.
Baudrillard. Baudrillard. Became shorthand for the franchise's success. And they're demonstrating their frustration for the first 110 minutes or so of this movie by putting action on the screen that looks like it was shot by a barely competent second unit. I mean, I'm not really exaggerating when I say that, like, Marvel...
Which is notable given that there was no second unit on this picture. Lana Wachowski shot all of it.
Marvel movies do better action. So take that for what you want. The movie fails on a basic storytelling level in the sense that very little of what is happening makes that much sense, and it fails on a basic action beat level. There's really only one interesting visual idea in the film, right? And that's this new thing, the swarm mode, where bots hidden in the program go crazy and they attack whatever target is presented to them. It's kind of we can debate on whether it's ham-fisted or not, but I think it's a little bit ham-fisted, but whatever. At least it's kind of a cool-looking visual metaphor for online mobs, right? They go and dominate discussions and disrupt things, etc. Though it's one that gets at one of the film's central problems for me, which is that it's almost a brief for schizophrenia. I mean, look, all I'm saying here is that if I had made a movie that literally inspired a mentally unstable person to kill people, and the original Matrix did do this, if you've watched the documentary A Glitch in the Matrix, you'll see. It literally, like, got somebody kind of crazy. They went out and killed somebody. Fine. You can't blame an artist for that. That you cannot blame an artist for what a mentally deranged person does, but it's what happened. I'm not sure I would make as my villain in a follow-on film a psychiatrist who wants the hero to get back on his meds because he's a danger to himself and others. I mean, it's just, you can't say that they're unaware of it because they're aware of every discussion about this film, as the rest of the film makes clear. It's kind of problematic. Anyway, there are things about the movie I like a bit. Particularly the acting. Jessica Henwick as Hacker Bugs is great. Yahya Abdul-Mateen II is kind of hilarious as weird, goofy Morpheus. And he has just the best wardrobe of anybody in the movie. Jonathan Groff, Neil Patrick Harris, they seem to understand the campy disaster that they found themselves in and are really hamming it up. But on the whole, it does not work on basically any level for me. On the other hand, maybe it's great. Alyssa, I think of the three of us, you enjoyed this film the most. What am I missing here?
I've gone back and forth on The Matrix Resurrections a lot, in part because watching it in the theater, I did sort of appreciate the nose-thumbing audacity of the concept, but it's really sort of receded in my mind the further I've gotten away from it, and I'm not that far away from it. I'm a couple weeks removed. The real pleasure of this movie is seeing Keanu Reeves and Carrie-Anne Moss together again, and the most human element of the film is actually sort of the one where the plot is most underdeveloped, and where the movie could have benefited from spending the most time. I sort of joked to Peter as we were walking out of the screening where we saw this, that this is a Matrix movie for people who really, really loved Cloud Atlas. And I'm one of those people who did love Cloud Atlas in a lot of ways, because it both has the same kind of meta, you know, examining itself technique that David Mitchell employs often, but it is essentially a story about people whose love is so powerful that it persists across, you know, different dimensions of reality and across reincarnations of their bodies, and that is the kind of, you know, I mean, that's sort of the concept of Cloud Atlas, which is about sort of resurrection and moral improvement across centuries. But it's also very sort of Wachowskian, right? I mean, the Wachowski sisters are very sentimental filmmakers on a lot of levels, that they make stuff that is, you know, they make genre films, they make action films, but a lot of what they make are just love stories. That's sort of the whole point of their Netflix series, Sense8. And yet, you know, that concept ends up just kind of underbaked in the movie. There is this literal throwaway line about how the analyst keeps resurrecting Trinity and Neo over and over again and trying to keep them apart because, you know, having them in tension is somehow key to the functioning of the Matrix. But they keep sort of finding their way back to each other. They keep reaching for each other with disastrous consequences for the machine's ability to maintain this illusion. And that's a really interesting idea that the movie just doesn't really explore at all. And Reeves and Carrie-Anne Moss are great together. I mean, that sort of sad scene in the coffee shop when they, you know, sort of first, when they, you know, meet, air quotes again, after they've both been sort of plugged back into the simulation is sort of lovely and awkward and middle-aged. Seeing them, you know, together when they're both successfully unplugged from the Matrix again, presented very much as these sort of androgynous halves of each other, is sort of, you know, has this passing beauty to it. But, you know, the movie as a whole just doesn't really...
Although, so I went and watched the first Matrix again, and it's also a kind of a reverse quote of the moment in the first film when, at the very, very end, when Trinity pulls Neo out of the Matrix right before they have to shut down, you know, use the EMP device, right? And she is pulling him out of the chair in that case, right? And like so much of this movie, it's either an inverted or a quote or a direct reference to an image or line or something from the first film.
But yeah, but they already did that in Reloaded. His Superman moment in Reloaded is him saving her from the fall and pulling the bullet out of her. It's they've already done all of this stuff.
Yeah, and it just,
all this has happened before. All of this will happen again.
But yeah, it does not really cohere as a thing. And it's sort of a bummer for the Wachowskis that they're stuck making, or at least for, you know, for Lana Wachowski, that she is making, you know, what's effectively like, I don't know what the budget on this was, $150 million,
something.
$190 million reported.
Okay, $190 million, like nose thumb at Warner Brothers. And I wish there was a world in which they could... You know, and Lily's writing for TV now. So it's like, I don't want to, it's always weird to project onto directors what they should be doing with their careers. But man, I would love to see the Wachowskis make something more original that cost less to make, so it mattered less when it inevitably failed or was weird. Because this is just kind of, it's just sort of a sour note. And, you know, maybe I will never recapture that feeling of being 15 and seeing The Matrix for the first time again, right? But I wish that this had advanced the conversation rather than really just plugging us back into the same old conceits.
Yeah. Peter, what did you make of this?
Like Alyssa, I thought this movie was intriguing and interesting at times, even kind of ambitious, kind of audacious. And I also don't think it really came together in the end. I think the meta gimmick is amusing at first. And then when you see how far they've decided to take it, and by they, I mean Lana Wachowski and her co-writers, David Mitchell, whose books I like, but has a reputation in the literary world for being, I think, what one of my friends once called, kind of a gimmick monger. And this movie feels like it was designed by a gimmick monger, someone who became obsessed with the gimmick at the expense of what the gimmick was there to do. And yes, it's cute that nearly every scene in the first two acts of this film is a direct reference to a comparable scene in the first film, occasionally in one of the sequels. Even, you know, the trip back to Zion is just, it's not quite beat for beat, but not the trip back to Zion, whatever the new human
Io.
City.
Io.
Io, that is just Zion again.
How dare
right?
you.
But
it's cool. But no, to be fair, this is a much cooler looking Zion. This is one of the few actual improvements.
It's also an extended reference to this scene in the first film with the Oracle, right? And so you even have the try it, it's delicious bit, right? Where they hand the somebody something, right? It's the, you know, here we're going to go
chocolate
see the old, you know, it's the old wise black woman who sort of delivers like the kind of, a little bit of a lesson and like some exposition, right, to sort of get things moving and like help the character center himself and what he's doing, right? This every single scene up until the very end of the last 30 minutes, 40 minutes or so is just a quote or a reference to the original. And why? Because it's a joke that sequels always have to do this, right? So if you watch Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 2, it is on the one hand a great movie, but the worst thing about it is that it's structurally almost exactly a repeat of Spider-Man 1, just with a little bit better and more extended action. Now, I think it's a better movie than Spider-Man 1, but it's like notably somebody in the studio, like they sat around and said, how can we do the same thing again, but more? Because that's the rules of big blockbuster sequels. And here they are making fun of the rules of big blockbuster sequels, but not really to any end. And I feel like, so just sort of to tie this together with one other thing that I think is actually important that you didn't talk about, Alyssa, but that we've all talked about offline. The first couple of films all had gimmicks, and they were all sort of filled with, like, there was some pseudo-intellectual claptrap in those movies, right? All of the stuff with the architect and whatever. Like, it's like, what is this? It doesn't really pay off. It doesn't really mean anything. But the first two films, and the first one in particular, work anyway, because those movies are tied together with just the most terrific, jaw-dropping action sequences you have ever seen. And those sequences hold up today, both in terms of the effects work. Like, some of it looks a little bit goopy, especially in like the 100 Smiths fight, right? There's a little bit of sort of digital, right? Oh, okay, you can tell this is old CG, but it looks much better than a lot of the contemporary Marvel CG at mega budget, right? And forget whether the CG looks perfect or not. Those scenes are perfectly clear and incredibly well-paced. They have like a rhythm to them, right? All of them were choreographed by Yuen Wu Ping, famous martial arts film director, and then a choreographer for American films. And all of Wu Ping's action sequences have, some people call it sort of a dance sensibility, but what I actually think about it is that it's conversational. Each person is trying a gambit, and they will like try something on each other, and then the other person will try something. And then there's always this thing that the first Matrix movies do so well, is there's a beat where they stop and they consider what the other person has just done. And it's almost like the action is continually resetting and evolving, right? And so what it allows you to do is follow these incredibly intricate, super awesome action beats in a way that this movie doesn't even have awesome action beats. And then it just sort of stages it all as like a junky clutter. And so when you've surrounded bad action sequences with this sort of like this go-nowhere gimmickry that David Mitchell has, I think, is probably at least somewhat responsible for, you just don't end up with much of a movie in the end.
And Peter, I want to go back to what you said about sort of the scene with the strawberry echoing the scene with the Oracle and the chocolate chip cookies. Because those two scenes together in particular get to me about a way in which The Matrix Resurrections is a failure. And so part of what's interesting about the original scene with Neo and the Oracle is both the way it sort of undercuts what you expect. When you talk about an oracle, you expect someone sort of, elevated and, you know, mysterious. And part of what's fascinating about that scene is that it's so mundane, right? It's an older African-American woman in her kitchen, making cookies, hanging out with some kids who are acting kind of weird. And she is inscrutable. She's not elevated. She, you know, sort of puts off a claim to higher knowledge. But the cookie she offers Neo, is a way of getting at, it's like reality is, you know, to what extent is reality rooted in your mind? To what extent is sort of pleasure and your existence, you know, where do those sensations come from? And, you know, the scene in Io has a really great premise, right? I mean, because the truth at the end of The Matrix Revolutions is that humans who want to leave the Matrix are allowed to leave. But, you know, the world that they're leaving for is pretty grim. And, you know, Io should be it should have been set up in this movie as an argument about the importance of pleasure and community and giving people a reason to leave, right? Like, if, you know, you need, you know, Bugs complains that Niobe is spending all of her time, you know, cultivating strawberries instead of freeing people from the Matrix. But you need the strawberries to get people to want to leave, to give them a reason to live in the world outside of the Matrix. You know, one of the, you know, the great scenes in the original is, you know, the traitor.
They should have just played pig during that sequence, right?
Yeah, to a certain extent. But, you know, you have, a character going back to the Matrix in part so he can eat a really great steak and have a wonderful bottle of wine, right? Like, there is an argument that being in the Matrix is more pleasurable than what Morpheus and his fellow human rebels have to offer. And Niobe's story should have been a sort of counter-argument to what Bugs is saying. It's like, yes, we need to spend time freeing people, but we also need to give them a reason to be free. You can't, you know, and to a certain extent, the closest The Matrix Resurrections gets to a big idea is, you know, sort of pushing back on contemporary social justice politics to a certain extent, right? I mean, you know, the fact that they include, like, the Matrix is about trans politics in the scenes that they're kind of making fun of the way people talk about the Matrix, even though Lily and Lana have said, you know, they were both closeted. They were not out yet when they made the first Matrix movie. Lana didn't even come out until the making of Cloud Atlas. You know, they have both said that that is true, and they're sort of making fun of that notion. Neil Patrick Harris's character, the analyst, is kind of a parody of contemporary therapeutic culture, right? I mean, there are actual therapeutic techniques he's using in those scenes with Neo, but, you know, when he talks about Neo being, you know, or Tom Anderson being triggered, you know, they're sort of making fun of that as well. And so, you know, the really powerful argument in that scene with Niobe and in the movie as a whole could have been to say, like, you cannot, as your politics, offer people like mush and misery and self-flagellation and expect large numbers of them to take you up on it, right? Like, you need to offer them pleasure and connection and, you know, reasons to sacrifice, you know, reasons to be in the world that you want to live in.
Which is funny, since this movie offers its viewers, I think, a lot of mush.
Yes, exactly. Well, there is a good big argument here, but if your big idea is that contemporary franchise culture is bad, you're still accepting the framework that contemporary franchise culture rules us all instead of breaking out beyond it entirely. And it's just, it's depressing to see filmmakers who did so much to make action movies and movies in general feel fresh, kind of accepting the logic.
Yeah.
It's a bummer.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, to get into all of that with old Niobe, you would have to lose 15 to 20 minutes of prattling at the beginning of this film. And that is clearly where their interests lie. Yeah. I mean, like, everybody wants to, you know, we can all talk about, like, oh, this is, it's not really about corporate franchise culture. It's about love. Well, the series is already about that. Like, the series has already done that. It's already done that, and it does it again here, and it doesn't really do it any better here. It actually does it much more dumbly here. Like, here's one very basic issue I have with this movie, is that it is never clear at all why Neo and Trinity need to be resurrected.
No.
the
Matrix.
More power for the Matrix, but, like, The Matrix is harvesting BTUs, not like brainwaves, right? Like, so, like, whatever.
I think it was that people resisted the new Matrix when they weren't together.
Stupid. Whatever the reason is, it's dumb. Doesn't make any sense.
But maybe that's just a metaphor for the franchise's rules. Is that, like, people resisted the Matrix if it will resist the Matrix movies if it doesn't have Keanu Reeves and Carrie Ann Moss getting together?
Anyway, there's so much that annoys me about this movie. I would just like to, again, praise Jonathan Groff and Yahya Abdul-Mateen II and
who's been great in some of the other everything he's been in for, like, a solid 2 years now. Just, like,
the only thing he has been in recently that I did not love him in was Aquaman, because he has kind of a nothing villain role in that. But he's great in Watchmen. He's great in Candyman.
I didn't love Aquaman very, very as a movie. I thought he was actually quite good at it.
He's good in the Trial of the Chicago 7.
I forgot. Yeah, yes. He's great.
He's in that too. Yeah. All right. So, what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on the Matrix Resurrections, Peter?
Sadly, a thumbs down.
Alyssa?
A regretful thumbs down.
Thumbs down. I wanted to love this, and I did not. And all of you nerds out there who are yelling at me for not loving it enough, you know, you're the swarm mode. How do you like that? I'm turning, flipping the tables on you, you idiots. All right, that's it for this week's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode on our favorite non-Matrix Wachowski film. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.